How many of you heard about the largest gold nugget ever found? Oh. Well, I hope so. It was found right up here in our backyard, right? Up here in the foothills. Weighed a little over 6 pounds, right? A gold nugget, can you imagine, as big as my fist? One solid gold nugget. It was auctioned off last week, and it was purchased by a private bidder, and the price was not revealed. So we don't know what it sold for, but it was estimated it was going to sell for somewhere between $350,000 and $400,000. And it's amazing that during the gold rush that was not discovered. It was only discovered recently, this gold nugget. Now, for treasure hunters like me, that gives us hope. I'm going to be planning a few hikes up there in the foothills later this year. There is treasure around, isn't there? One of the favorite shows that Linda and I like to watch on public television is Antique Roadshow. Anybody ever watch that show? Oh, good. We have a few public television watchers. And Linda has a favorite expression, especially when they analyze somebody's object that they brought to the roadshow, and it's worth lots of money. For example, recently one lady came in and she had this vase. She brought it a jade vase, and it had been given to her by her grandfather who bought it in Asia, 50 years ago. And she brought it in, and he asked her how much the auctioneer or the appraiser said, how much do you think it's worth? And she said, I don't know, a couple hundred bucks. And he said, well, try again. It's worth over $300,000. Sometimes you have these treasures that really surprise us, right? And Linda's favorite expression is, sell it. Sell it. I don't need a $300 vase. I need the money. And whenever somebody has something that's appraised at a very high value, Linda goes, sell it. Get rid of it. We all desire treasure, don't we? One thing that Linda and I have thought about lately is divesting ourselves of our collection of stuff. Over the years, we collect things, don't we? Our personal treasures. Right now, we have in our garage about 4 or 5 pieces of furniture that we're going to bequeath to our daughter. She's looking for a house right now to buy, and when she buys a house, she's going to need to furnish it. So we're saving some of our stuff. We're downsizing, and we're going to give some of our furniture to our daughter. And we may be moving again within the year wherever Linda finds work. Linda's going to be looking for work, I think I've told you. And we're going to be moving closer to where her place of work is, somewhere here in Central California. And we're thinking of downsizing, especially if we move closer to the Bay Area where the real estate prices are much higher. We're going to end up probably in a refrigerator box under a bridge. But we're thinking of downsizing, needing a smaller place than we've had in the past. And when you downsize, what do? You get rid of things, right? You've collected. If you've been in your house 15, 20, 30 or more years, how much stuff have we collected? All of our treasures, right? All of this treasure. I'd like to go to Matthew 6, Matthew the 6th chapter. In verse 19, Christ said, Matthew 6, verse 19, in the middle of these, what is commonly called the Beatitudes, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. What do you suppose is going to happen to that nugget somebody may have paid close to $400,000 for? I dare say he's not going to melt it down. Biggest nugget ever found, that's historical. I dare say he's not going to put a hole in it and put it around his neck on a necklace. Probably not going to put it in a sitting and make a ring out of it, is he? No, it's way too big for that. What's he going to do with it? He's going to put it in a vault, right, for safekeeping. He's going to pull it out every once in a while, look at it. right? And then what's he going to do? What did Steve Jobs do with all the millions and millions of money that he made with his breakthroughs with Apple? He died, you know. What happened to all that money? Well, like the Song of Solomon says, you leave it to somebody else who doesn't appreciate it, right? I dare say that gold nugget that's in somebody's vault today is going to be given to his descendants or someone that he leaves it to, his mate, his wife maybe. What value is it in the long run? As we get older, we realize that things that are important to us are not so much stuff anymore, but it's relationships that are more important to us. And I think that's what Christ was getting at here in verse 19. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and dust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. I've thought about this verse quite a bit lately because, like I said, we moved and we're downsizing and we had all this stuff, way too much stuff that we had to move with us and that we're now trying to download to our kids. And I think we probably all go through these cycles of life. Gail Sheehy called them the passages of life. You know, when you... When you're starting your family, and like our daughter is, they want to have a baby and they want to have a house in which they can have that baby. So they're kind of at the entrance level of that. They want to buy a house. They want to furnish it. They want to collect things. They want to have children to share with. You know, they're going to be building. And my wife's daughter has this concept. She worked for a property management firm for a while, and she got this idea that what she wants to do is the house they're going to buy this time, their first home, is going to become a rental property. You know, and then they're going to have another rental property and another rental property, and you're just going to keep on the non-regression theory. You know, that's what she wants to do, which is a wonderful goal. If she can do it, that's great, if they can afford to do that. But when you get to be a little older in life, you think about different things, don't you? I thought about this in spiritual terms, too. I'd like to ask the question, how do we lay up treasure in heaven? How do we do that? How do we lay up treasure in heaven? Well, let's go back to chapter 6 and verse 1 and read what Christ says about treasures and those things we collect. He says, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men, that is to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, so he seems to be saying charitable deeds are good, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues, in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. That's it, to be seen of men. That's their reward. Oftentimes, men and women of wealth will give big donations to hospitals, universities, and in exchange, the university will name a school after them, or a building, or a hospital will name a wing after somebody, or a clinic, because this person or this family gave a big endowment to the school or the hospital. But when you do a charitable deed, in verse 3, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. In other words, do it quietly and privately, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. So there seems to be this reward, this treasure in heaven seems to be associated with, same chapter here, same context, with charitable deeds. Now, I've thought a lot about this lately because a little over a year ago, Mr. Franks asked me to sit on the board of Foundation Outreach International. I think most of you know what Foundation Outreach International is. It is a nonprofit organization that was formed to assist the church in doing charitable deeds for its own members and other people. So as not to take funds from the mission of the church. In other words, we could do these things without dipping into the first tithe accounts. And some of the projects that we've sponsored in the past include scholarships for students in Central and South America. And we're talking about college students. Scholarships for children in the Philippines, where the average student drops out of school in 7th, 8th grade. This gives them money because they need money. They need tuition to go beyond the 8th grade in the Philippines. It provides funds to help sponsor the teaching of English and computer skills in Zimbabwe and Zambia and Africa, and also staff summer camps in places like Ghana and Nigeria. It provides funds so that we can sponsor young adults to go to Jordan for a 10-month project, and we've done that for the last several years. Just a few things that FOI is doing. We're getting into more programs. I'll tell you about one that we're considering that I really think is worthwhile, and that's why I'm working with Dr. Schwartz to promote it. Maybe some of you know Greg Schwartz. He is a dentist in the church. He lives in North Carolina. He moved there from Missouri, I think, last year, and he has a practice with his daughter, who's also a dentist in the Carolinas. He's also an elder in God's church, he made a trip to Rwanda with Mr. Meeker one year. He's just kind of curious and volunteered to go with Mr. Meeker, who usually takes these trips alone to Africa. In fact, Mr. Meeker left Thursday, for a trip to Africa. And you might be remembering him in your prayers with everything that's going on with the Ebola, because he will be going to the Ivory Coast, which is very close to Liberia in Africa. But anyway, to get back to my story about Dr. Schwartz, when he got to Rwanda, he noticed that the dental hygiene of the people, obviously without dentistry, a lot of dentists, was pretty poor. And so what he did is he volunteered to examine everybody's teeth in the church there. And so he borrowed a dental clinic. And he examined everybody's teeth, and he made recommendations, and he actually extended his stay, and he spent a couple of weeks, and he did dental work for all the members in Rwanda, in the church there. And he went back the next year, and he did the same thing. He stayed 2 weeks, took 2 weeks vacation, and did this dental work for the members. And one time I saw him at a ministerial conference, and he just returned from Rwanda, and I asked him, I said, well, how's your work going there? And he says, well, let's put it this way. He says, the church members in Rwanda have the best teeth in the country. And when he got back, he was telling some of his colleagues in the dental field about his progress. And they said, well, we'd like to contribute. What do they need over there? And he said, well, the dentists, even though they're trained, most of them in England or South Africa, and they know their stuff, they're just limited by poor equipment. They don't have the latest x-ray equipment. They don't have modern chairs. You know, they don't have good instruments. They need all that stuff. And so Mr. Schwartz found that there were other dentists who were willing to donate dental equipment. And then he found a large dental outfit in, I believe it was St. Louis, Missouri, who was willing to give $100,000 worth of brand new equipment. And so Mr. Schwartz started a nonprofit called Smile Rwanda, where he sends dental equipment, dental instruction. He goes over there for 2 or 3 weeks every year and gives instructions to dentists on the latest procedures. And anyway, he and I got to talking, and I said, well, look, this would be a great program for FOI, you know, where members of the church would like to contribute towards a program like this. And so we're getting more and more involved in programs like that with people who are already doing charitable work like the one I just described, Dr. Schwartz in Smile Rwanda. So I've been thinking a lot about FOI and contributions that people give, and some of our members work for companies that do matching funds. They won't match funds for the church. They don't want to give to a church organization, but they will match funds for a charitable organization. So if somebody wants to give, for example, Bank of America is a good example. We have a couple of members that work for Bank of America. They're vice presidents for Bank of America down in Texas. And if they want to contribute $5,000 to FOI, then Bank of America will match. They'll give another $5,000. So you end up with a $10,000 donation to FOI. And so we have found a few members that are working for companies that are willing to do that. And so we have raised over $100,000 just on matching funds that have been contributed to FOI. So as a board member, I've been thinking about, why do people give to charities? And I came across a very interesting book. Actually, it's a publication put out by the Federal Reserve Bank. It's entitled The Economics of Charitable Giving, What Gives? And it's really interesting. Let me just read the conclusion they came to. Although some people may be altruistic when giving, economics tells us that the dominant motivation is the internal satisfaction that individuals derive from the act of giving. Did you hear that? The reason most people give is to make themselves feel good. Which I thought was a pretty interesting conclusion. And so then I thought, well, okay, let's read a little further in the publication and find out specifically the five top reasons that people generally donate time and resources to charitable causes. This is what they give. This is what people give as the top five reasons, even though the conclusion was that most people give so that they'll feel better personally. Let me go through these five reasons. Number one, personal experience. Donors will often feel an affinity for a cause for a variety of reasons related to their personal life experiences. Let me give you an example. The American Cancer Society. Their biggest pool of donors are people who have had cancer. And they target, with all their fundraisers, they target cancer victims or those who have survived cancer. In 1992, I was standing on a subway platform in New York City next to a friend of mine. We were on our way into downtown New York to listen to his children who were performing with the New York Youth Philharmonic Orchestra. And he looked behind my ear and he said, Dave, what's that behind your ear? I said, oh, it's just a mole. He said, how long have you had it? And I said, about a year. And he said, does it bother you? I said, no. He said, if I were you, I'd get that looked at. Well, I'm like most of you. I hate doctors, right? I just don't like to go see doctors. They're okay for somebody else, but not me. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll check it out, intending not to. And then he said, you remember Bob, and he mentioned Bob by name. He said, you remember Bob Justice, don't you? I said, well, yeah, of course. He said, did you hear that Bob died of cancer last year? Whoa. He's young. How did that happen? And he explained to me that Bob had a melanoma on his shoulder. It appeared as a mole, and he ignored it. And the next thing you know, it had advanced into his whole system, basically. So that's one of the nasty things about melanoma. It's like kind of like the iceberg. You know, you see a little mole, but below it, it has all these fingers that go out into the body and then gets into the bloodstream and major organs. And so I went to the doctor when I got home after that story, and the doctor looked at my mole, and he says, "Well, Dave, let me take a biopsy." He did a biopsy, and he called me up, and he said, "Dave, we need to talk." And I went into his office, and he said, "Dave, you've got cancer." I said, "You're kidding. You know, those are words that are for other people, not me." He said, "Dave, you've got cancer. You've got melanoma, and we need to get that out of there right away." And after three surgeries, thankfully, he got it all, and I haven't had any recurrence. But I go to a dermatologist every 6 months and get a checkup and get things burned off my face and my back, you know, because I was a lifeguard when I was in high school and college. I spent a lot of time in the sun, and I had too much sun. And now I have to be very careful of skin cancer. But right after that visit, I started getting letters from the American Cancer Society. I don't know if the doctors have some way of reporting to them or what it is, but I began getting all this solicitation for funds. Support the American Cancer Foundation. And like I said, through personal experience, they will solicit funds from people who've either survivors or people who are going through cancer treatment. Number two is people say they want to make a difference. People say they want to make a difference. People often say they donate or volunteer in order to make a difference. This phrase means many different things to different people. Some people want to make an impact in the lives of the individual person. They would like to see a lasting and tangible change as a result of their contribution. Again, I recently saw an example of this on public television where they were interviewing a woman, a minority, who couldn't afford to go to college when she was younger, but when she got older, she decided to go to school. She got an education, and she became very successful in her field. And she wanted to give something back to her community, which had a high school graduation rate of about 40%. It was terrible in these United States. And so she went back to that community where she grew up, and she said, "If you finish high school, I will give you the money to go to college." That's what she told the junior high students. And so kids, hey, this sounds like a good deal. And they began to stay in school. They began to graduate from high school. And she lived up to her word. She began to give them scholarships to go to college. And I forget the exact number, but at last count it was something like 1,500 or 2,000 scholarships this woman's charity had given for children to be able to go to college. And it wasn't just her now, because people wanted to join this cause. They wanted to make a difference, and she began to get contributions from hundreds of other people, thousands perhaps, for her cause. Number three, the third reason that people give to charities, is they want to do something active about a problem or take a stand on a particular issue. Today, we are bombarded by information about the world's problems through a whole variety of channels. Although we may isolate ourselves, we can't escape from knowing about misery, injustice, and wasted human potential. Often we feel powerless in the face of these grim realities. Charity offers us a way to respond. Maybe you've seen these ads on television where they say, "For $19 a month, you know, you can help this child," and they show you pictures of these starving children. That's what they're talking about, where people, they want to do something actively to mitigate the suffering in the world. Number four, people are motivated by personal recognition and benefit. People are motivated by personal recognition or benefit. And as I said earlier, this is where people donate in exchange for public acknowledgement of some kind, a plaque on the wall, the wing of the hospital named after their family, a brick, you know, in the courtyard, whatever it is, they get public acknowledgement. Basically, the author of the article writes, you appeal to donors' egos or to those who desire to heighten their public image when you offer to recognize their gift as an open and tangible, in an open and tangible way. Many people like to be publicly acknowledged for the gifts to charity. Just like the Pharisees in Christ's day, who actually carried with them a trumpeter, and when they came up to drop alms in the courtyard of the synagogue, you know, the trumpeter would blast, everybody would look, oh, a rich man is giving. And that's why Christ said they had their reward. That was it. People acknowledged them. And number five is the concept that we have in America that giving is a good thing to do. Giving is a good thing to do. It's an accepted moral or spiritual obligation. And many of us have probably helped someone on the street or a street corner. They say they're hungry. I know I've done this before. I am very careful about giving money to such people because I think 90% of the time they're going to spend it on alcohol or drugs. But I have offered to buy somebody a sandwich. Or, come on, I'll take you over to McDonald's if you're hungry for something to eat. I mean, we understand that whole concept, don't we? About giving is a good thing. In fact, Proverbs 14:21 says, he who despises his neighbor sins, but he who has mercy on the poor, happy is he. So it's a biblical principle to help people out who are less fortunate than ourselves. Let's go to Luke chapter 10. Luke 10 and verse 30. It's kind of interesting to me. As I was doing this research, while you're turning to Luke 10, I read in a book entitled Launching a Leadership Revolution by Chris Brantley and Orrin Woodward. They're talking about leadership roles and what leaders do. And he said, first, we can be wise stewards when we understand that none of our possessions are our possessions. They belong to God. And we will all be called to account for how we use what he has entrusted to us. The second consideration of good stewardship is that we should spend our loaned resources in light of God's priorities rather than ours. Our sacrifice honors him and displays obedience to Jesus' command to store up our treasures in heaven rather than on earth. And we read that scripture. So how do we lay up treasure in heaven? Well, I just read to you from Matthew that we should do charitable deeds, but in private. Let's go to Luke 10 and verse 30. Something you're probably familiar with, the story of the Good Samaritan. In verse 30, we read, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. And if you've ever been along this road, it's a desolate road that drops almost 4,000 feet in elevation over approximately 25 miles. You go from the mountains around Jerusalem down a winding road through what is called today the Judean Desert, which is terribly rough, rocky, destitute of any vegetation to speak of except just a few little bushes growing out of the crags of the rocks. It's not far from this area where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found by a shepherd that was looking for his goats. And remember, he threw a rock in a cave and heard a clay pot break and discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. Not far from this area. Very desolate area where thieves could hide easily in a canyon. Anyway, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a certain priest came down the road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Didn't want to get involved. Likewise, a Levite, when he arrived at the place, came and looked and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. On the next day, when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said to him, "Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you." And Christ said, "So which of these three do you think was neighbor to him who fell among thieves?" And the man said to him, "He who showed mercy on him." And Jesus said, "Go and do likewise." God wants us to practice charitable deeds. Go and do likewise. But it should be motivated out of compassion. Not because we want somebody to know what we did. Not because we want to be acknowledged for it. Not because we expect something in return. Like I said, I've been giving this a lot of thought, especially in light of serving on this board and examining what kind of activities we should sponsor, how we should solicit people to give to FOI. And I find this whole concept of giving, which Christ certainly supports, but the key seems to be attitude, doesn't it? Turn with me to Romans chapter 12 and verse 8. Romans 12 and verse 8, he's talking to the Roman church. And in chapter 12 and verse 1, he says, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable or logical service." God expects us to give of ourselves. And notice what he says in verse 8, because this begins to get into the attitude of why we do what we do. "He who exhorts in exhortation." In other words, he who encourages, exhortation is encouragement. He who encourages, let him do that with an attitude of encouragement. Not because we have to. Like if you know somebody's going through a trial and you come up to them and you say, "Well, I hope you're doing better." And we walk away and forget them. "But I hope you're doing better. You know, I pray for you all the time. I'm concerned about you." Is there a difference in either one of those approaches? He who gives with liberality. In other words, when we give, when we do our charitable deeds, do we do it with an attitude of a willingness, not a selfishness? I was talking, my wife and I actually were counseling with someone not too long ago, and they were describing someone that was very close to them, and this person described them as someone who was stingy and tight. I said, "You can't get a nickel out of them." That seems to be the opposite of what is being said here. He who gives with liberality. I mean, not giving beyond what we can afford, obviously. I'm not saying that, but just to always have this generous sense about us. There are other people that I've heard about, and people say of them, "Oh, he'd give you the shirt off of his back." You ever heard that expression? Which describes someone who gives with liberality. He who leads with diligence, consistency, and he who shows mercy with cheerfulness. not begrudgingly giving mercy, but with cheerfulness. I think we can see that the most important thing behind charitable giving, the way to build treasure in heaven, is the attitude. What's in our mind, and more importantly, what is in our heart? You're probably saying, okay, what's Mr. Register talking about? Do you want us to give to FOI? Not especially. That's not what this sermon is about. As I was going through these reasons for why people give, it dawned on me. In fact, I've thought about it many times, but not in this context. And that is, why do people come to church? Why do people come to church? Some people come here because the truth is here. And they want the truth. Some people come here because it's a very accepting community. Church is generally accepting. You know, you might get rejected in some other community, maybe your family or your neighborhood or at work, but the church is very accepting. We give people the benefit of the doubt. You come in the door, we say, hey, you're probably here for the same reason I am, the truth of God. What drew you to God's church? What keeps you here? Why do we attend church? Is it so that we can tell other people? You know, I'm a Christian. I go to church every week. No. Why are we here? What are the reasons that we attend? It's just like giving in many ways. There's more to it than just being here, isn't there? Why do we come here? Well, I think we get an insight when we talk about the words and advice of the Apostle Paul. Let's go back to verse 1 of chapter 12. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. When Christ came to this earth and left us an example, what was his motive? Why did he do what he did? Did he say, well, my father and I, before we ever created the earth, decided that I was going to come, and I'm committed, and I'm going to come. Did he do it out of a sense of obligation? Do we come to church because we feel obliged? Well, if I don't come, the minister might call and see how I'm doing. And I was just playing hooky, really. Do we come here because we think we'll be missed? You know, and only you can answer this, just like only I can answer this, what's going on deep inside with what we do? That's why I wanted to approach this from the point of view of charitable giving, because it challenges us to do that from deep within inside of what is in each of us. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13. In verse 3, this, of course, is the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. In verse 3, and though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. In other words, there's no treasure laid up in heaven, even going through the acts of martyrdom. That's what he's talking about here, being burned, or charitable giving, unless the heart is right. Which challenges all of us, I think, to ask the question, why do we come to church? Why do we attend here? Probably for the same reason that we give. Because we love. Because we have the love of Christ. Christ did what he did because of he and the Father's love for us. If we love one another, we're going to serve one another, aren't we? Do we come to church to serve others, or do we come to serve ourselves? It's kind of an interesting discussion I had about a week and a half ago. Linda and I were trying to replace a piece of furniture that we had sold before we came down, and we found we had a spot for it, for this piece that we got rid of. And so we started looking on Craigslist, and we found a little cabinet that would just fit, at least it looked like it would, in this hole that we have in our house. And so we went to visit these people who had this little cabinet listed on Craigslist, and very interesting people. They live over in Granite Bay. In a very nice home. The father is a fireman, works down in Fresno, kind of a long commute, but he works down there three on, four off, or four on, three off, whatever the fireman schedules are. He has three little kids and a wife, of course. They live in this house. They just moved there not too long ago, and they were trying to get rid of this cabinet. And in the course of negotiating for this cabinet, my wife hates it, but I love to negotiate. You know, I just, all those trips to Tijuana when I lived in Southern California, I guess. They're asking this, and I offer this, and I like to negotiate. And in the course of our negotiations, he told me he was a fireman, and he asked me what I did. Now, this is always an interesting juncture in conversation with anybody, especially those people who are not in the church, is, what do you do for a living? Because then, once they find out I'm a pastor, all the rules change in the discussion. It's kind of interesting. Years ago, when I lived in Boston, there was a golf course very close to me there that offered clergy privileges on Monday mornings. In other words, if you were a minister, you know, you worked all day Sunday, and the golf course had this old tradition. It was a very old golf course that, if you came on Sunday mornings as a minister, you could golf for free. Well, naturally, I wanted to take advantage of this privilege, clergy privilege, so I'd go over to the golf course, and they would team me up with three other golfers who usually were not preachers or ministers. And, of course, we'd start playing golf, and what's your name? I'm Fred. You know, I'm Dave. We kind of go for two or three holes, and these guys would be talking about what they did on the weekend. I got drunk, I did this, you know, I did this conquest, and they'd tell two or three dirty jokes. Of course, most of the time I'm over in the bushes looking for my ball. But finally, about the fourth or fifth hole, they would always ask this question, you know, what do you do for a living? And then I would drop the little bombshell, you know, I'd say, well, I'm a church pastor. And they'd get quiet. And you could tell they're rerunning the tape. What did I say? What did I do? What joke did I do? Ooh, busted, you know. And then for the next few holes, they're telling me, well, you know, back in 1968, I accepted the Lord into my life, and I attend the Methodist church down the street. You know, for the next two or three holes, it's how good they are, because they got to impress me. At least they think they do. Anyway, it was kind of interesting when I went to pick up this cabinet and we were having the chat with the fireman. He asked me what I did for a living, and I told him, I'm a minister. Oh, where's your church? I said, well, we meet down in Citrus Heights. Oh, that's not far. He started asking questions. And he said, well, my wife and I basically grew up, we're unchurched, but now we got kids and we're thinking about going to church so that the kids can have lessons, can learn about God. And I go, oh, I say, well, we kind of teach that's the responsibility of the parents. And, we start talking a little more, and then he begins to hint around, well, my wife and I are thinking about coming back or coming to church. Where is your church, you know, down there? And as we get deeper and deeper in this discussion, I finally just say, well, we keep Saturday Sabbath, and we observe God's annual holy days. Whoa. I mean, suddenly we're different. Conversation changes again. But what struck me is the reason he wanted to go to church was to provide moral education for his children, which is not uncommon for young families, even unchurched young families. I want to go to church to have my kids taught. Other people want to go to church to have a social life. Not too long ago, Linda and I were talking to somebody who doesn't attend our church who had kind of rambunctious children, and she said, I go to this big mega church because they have a nursery there and they babysit my children and I get some relief from my kids. So the primary reason this woman goes to this church is because she gets relief from her children because they have a good nursery there. It always strikes me, it's incredible the reasons that people choose churches. It's close, it's handy for networking. I've heard people tell me, oh, I go to church for networking. You know, you really get good clients there. And I've got this pyramid organization, and, you know, I can kind of farm the church, you know. And I ask the question, why do we go to church? Are we laying up treasure on earth to go here? What's the reason? Why are we here? Is it for social reasons? Or is it out of a deep-seated love for other people? And if it is, if we're following the example of Christ, then we should want to serve, should we not? We should want to give from in here. Do we come to church to give, or do we come to church to get? What's in it for me? You ever heard that expression? What's in it for me? Do you have a good program there? Do you have good music? Lots of singing? What do you have there for me? What's the benefit I get out of it? Is that our approach? Should it be? No, I think we should have a very similar approach to church as we do to charitable giving. I'm here to serve. I'm to extend love that comes from deep down inside of me to other brethren in the church, because if you look around the room, this is Christ. This is the body of Christ. I think it's important for us to think about this very important topic. Let's go to Matthew 25. Matthew 25 and verse 31. Matthew 25, verse 31. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne in His glory. Now verse 32 of Matthew 25. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And He shall set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on His left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer and say, Well, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And verse 40, the king answered and said, Say to them, Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did this to one of the least of my brethren, you did it to me. That's the kind of service that comes from the heart. It comes from the heart. The key to service and to giving is motive. We read in Romans 12:1 that we're to give our lives in sacrifice of service, to follow the example of Christ. We've probably seen people who do this. Most of us. I certainly have. I remember a woman in the Boston church. I can use her name. She's now dead. She passed away several years ago. Her name was Mrs. Rose. I'll never forget Mrs. Rose. She made such an impact on me. She lived in public housing, a public housing high-rise apartment in downtown Boston. I remember every time I went to visit her, it took me sometimes 20, 30 minutes to find a parking spot. When I'd find a parking spot, then I would have to go into the, it was a public housing area, and it was low income. Sometimes I felt like I was in danger. But here was this widow. She lived very high up in this building, and she was blind. She had lost her sight because of sugar diabetes complications. And over the course of her deteriorating health, she was confined to a wheelchair. So here was this lady in a public tenement in downtown Boston, blind and in a wheelchair, and yet she made sure that she was at church every Sabbath. And I said, why make the effort? Why be there? She had to get herself from what, I forget whatever floor it was, 15th, 16th floor, down to the street. She had to get herself to the bus stop and then get on the bus and go to an area where she could meet her ride that would bring her to church. I said, why do you go through that effort? And she says, well, because there are people that I want to see at church because I pray for them all the time. There are people that I want to fellowship with. Those are my brothers and sisters. There are people there that I want to serve. She was probably the most prolific card and letter writer of anybody in that congregation when I was there. She wrote letters and cards of encouragement to everybody. Just something she did. She dictated them because she couldn't write them herself. She dictated them to her nurse. Her nurse wrote them. We had a fundraiser every year in the Boston church that raised funds for our kids to go to camp. And we used to sell fruit baskets that we'd make up for Thanksgiving and sell those. You know, we'd wrap them in cellophane, and we had a big church fundraiser. And most people who did really well sold about 45 or 50 baskets. Mrs. Rose, every year, sold over 500 baskets. You thought, how can she do that? Well, she went to every apartment in that tenement. And these are people, low-income people. And she got them to buy fruit baskets. And I said, well, why would you go through that effort? Why would you do that? And she said, well, those kids that we send to camp, those are my kids. They're church kids. I'm going to see them go to camp. Like I said, every church virtually has a person who serves like that. I dare say we have people who serve like that in our church, in our congregation, who are willing to sacrifice time, energy, and effort, even, you know, when we wouldn't expect them to. Sacrificing our time is very important to God, especially if it comes from the heart, like our giving should be. People have called me on the phone, you know, late at night or early in the morning, saying, well, Mr. Register, I hate to put you out, but, you know, can you come and anoint me, or can you help me this way? And I go, please don't say that. That's what I'm here for. Right? That's what I'm here for. Don't worry about that. Let's go to Psalms 112. Psalms 112. Psalms 112, verse 1. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord and delights greatly in his commandments. So we're talking about someone that God considers to be righteous. In verse 9, it says, he has dispersed abroad. He has given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. His horn will be exalted with honor. Why? Because he's laying up treasure in heaven. Because he serves out of a genuine heart. The reason he's at church is because he loves to be at church. He loves the brethren. He loves to learn because he knows that learning is going to enable him to give in the kingdom of God, to be a judge, to be a king, to be a priest in God's kingdom. I have been asked to be a new pastor to all of you, And I love this opportunity, as I've told you before. I today have a congregational survey that I'd like to give to everybody. Some people in the back, they're on the sound table. If a couple of you could go back there and grab those surveys and pass them out. Thank you. It's a typical congregational survey. I'm asking for input from all of you on socials, suggestions for socials, if you'd like to do more than we're doing. I don't really know all that we're doing. And what I'd like to do is get your input and then have a meeting with the elders and deacons. And then we'll put together more socials or less or whatever your feedback is. And there's some feedback it asks about the pastor. Maybe you don't know me well enough to give me that feedback yet. Because this is just, it's a standard, generic survey that I would give at the end of every year, every 2 years in the local congregation here. And I also have a yellow sheet of paper, different color. Please take your time with this survey. You can either hand it in today or you can hand it in after church next week. Next week, I'd like to collect them over this week and next. This yellow one, the yellow sheet you're going to get here in just a moment, is called Making a Difference, Serving in the Local Church. Most of my pastor friends and I, when we talk at the conference, we kind of cry on each other's shoulders and we say, you know, most congregations are 80-20. You know, you've got 20% of the congregation does all the serving and 80% soak it up, you know, absorb it. And as your pastor, I would like to think that everybody in the congregation can serve in some way out of a pure heart, like I've been describing in the scriptures. And so this particular sheet, this yellow sheet, lists, and again, this is very generic, and for all I know and what I expect is that every responsibility is already taken care of here and taken care of very well. So it is not my intent, you know, to revolutionize the congregation or to turn things over. But it has a place for your name, and it lists various areas of service in the church. Where would you like to serve? And like I said, I would like to think that everybody in the congregation can serve in some way or another. Everybody. So I would appreciate it if you would consider where you would like to serve. You may already serve in this position. That's great. If you like it, you might even just say, you know, I already serve at the sound booth and I really like it. That's wonderful. And two or three other people may say, you know, I'd like to serve in the sound booth. Well, you know, we need mentorees in all these areas, somebody that can be mentored in case somebody's sick or absent or the next generation. I particularly like it when young people, you know, sign up a list like this and say, I'd like to serve in this area, that area. So hopefully you can find an area or more that you would like to serve in, and you'll put your name in those areas where you would like to serve in the congregation, as we have been discussing. Because in so doing, we actually, I believe, lay up treasure in heaven. That's how we do it, is giving. Giving generously of our time, because most of us don't have great resources, so we give of our time in the local church. And I think God respects that as much as he does giving resources, especially when it's done from the right attitude and the right heart. I'd like to close by going to Acts chapter 20, verse 35. As I said, the important thing is that we do serve. Whether we serve the needy outside the church, or whether we serve the needy in the church, or whether we just serve the congregation as a whole, that we do it with a loving attitude that comes from the heart. And we do it because we want to give to other people. We're just not here to take. We want to give to others. Because the more we give, the more we get back. It's the law that God has developed and built for us. especially those of us who follow Christ's example. The more that he gave, the more he got. The more he will get. Acts chapter 20, verse 35 says, I have shown you in every way, Paul wrote, or actually said, by laboring like this, that you must support the weak. And remember the words of the Lord Jesus, that he said, it is more blessed to give than to receive.